Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to MXP number 2. I'm Chris Pajak, that is Paul Meacham. Before we get into it, I just want to say from me anyway, and I'm sure Paul will add to this, thank you so much for all the feedback from last week's episode. It's been absolutely insane. I mean, over 400 comments, so many people getting in touch on Twitter, on Facebook, even on Instagram. It's actually been a little bit overwhelming, Paul.
Yeah, no, absolutely, completely made up, because there was a running joke, obviously, we've got to 10K without any content. Puts a modicum of pressure on your first piece of content,
just
doesn't it?
Just a little bit.
And it's all of our own making, so no, I'm pleased that people have enjoyed it so far. But doesn't mean we stop.
No. There's a few people said it was the best video we've ever done.
Wow.
I disagree.
Well, I know what people... I mean, that's their opinion, isn't it? You can disagree or agree. It should be. The most recent thing should always be the best thing we've done, because we've learned along the way.
See, I'm still a fan of the old Footy Manager series. That was it. That was something that I don't think we'll top for a long time, unless we do it on this channel.
No, we've had some requests to do it on this channel as well. Maybe. I've had it written in my head for a long time. It would be lovely to go and do that again. If you've not watched the first series, that you don't know what we're talking about, the CMO 102 challenge, it's on the Retro Football channel. It's still there. It's still brilliant.
Listen, anyway, it's time, and I've been trying to work this out in my head, what's the best way to say this, because I feel like this section needs a jingle. It's the purge.
The purge.
We definitely need a jingle for that, though.
I agree.
If someone can send in a jingle, that would be incredible. So it's the purge first and foremost. So what we're doing each and every single week is we're picking something, Paul, that's done our head in over the last week. So what is it this week for you, mate?
This is another one that I've pulled from the archive, because I've got a bank of them that have been doing me in my entire life, but I've never had the platform on which to truly express how much I hate these things. Last week it was question marks. This week it's people who can't see over the steering wheel of their cars. This is not a shortest thing, by the way. This is an idiot thing, because even in, and we're not even talking about the most modern of motorised vehicles, it's possible to adjust the seat.
It is.
But literally, and this is one of those things, and if you've never got onto this before, now that I've mentioned it, I apologise, because it's like when you get a new car, or you're looking to buy a new type of car, or your mate gets a new car, and you see that car absolutely everywhere all of a sudden. Like, I'd never noticed the Citroën Picasso in my life until you have one, and I see
fucking
them.
Tons of them, mate.
They're everywhere,
and they're all in my colour.
They're all absolutely everywhere. And I'm like, oh, Chris. No, it's not Chris. Honestly, like, how can people think it's acceptable to drive a car when basically your vision is obscured of the road by the steering wheel? How can police will stop you for being on your mobile phone? I'm sorry, but if I'm on my mobile phone, I can still see the entirety of what's in front of me. People like getting into the football and makeup on and all these kind of things. Again, you look, it's someone just needs, if you've got a family member who does this, pull them to one side. It can't be safe. It cannot be safe to effectively have a semicircle across your vision. Get a booster seat or something, because you can't be
slightly embarrassing though getting a booster seat.
What's more embarrassing, being in a booster seat or crashing your car into someone because you cannot see the car in front of you because you've got a fucking steering wheel in your face?
I'm not sure what's more embarrassing. I think the booster seat might be more embarrassing.
I mean, okay,
you can blame someone else for the car crash.
Yeah, I know, but it's like It's like using a novelty condom or no condom. It's a bit embarrassing having a novelty condom, but like maybe it's not embarrassing having an illegitimate child or having to go through being a parent. Safety first is what I'd say.
Okay, I like that. Mine's emails.
Just emails.
Well, no, I'm going to break it down a little bit more than emails.
Like your email inbox.
Yeah, my email inbox. So when did emails become the new instant messaging? As in, like, someone will email you and then you'll get a WhatsApp off them like 5 minutes later and go, did you see my email? Yeah, I did. Did you want to reply straight away? Because it didn't say fucking urgent on it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? All of a sudden, emails have become this thing that you need to drop everything for and send the reply.
I have a rank order of importance and what I will respond to, and it goes face-to-face, phone call, yeah, text/WhatsApp, probably WhatsApp slightly above because you've got the red thing on it. And emails is down there with the only thing that's below emails is the written letter. Emails, I treat emails like they're meant to be, that it's electronic mail. I will get to it when I'm good and ready.
You know, I think you've got 4 days before you need to respond to an email.
If you're honestly
looking. And if it's important, fucking phone me.
Yeah.
Can
I ask a question?
Go on.
I know the answer, but for the listeners, how many unread emails on average do you have in your email inbox?
I mean, right now, mm-hmm, none.
I think I have 22,000.
Yeah.
And I'm fascinated. We talked last week a little bit about the differences in personality. I think there are genuinely, you know, there's so many ways to categorize people.
How many email folders have you got in your inbox?
I have a handful, but I don't use them. It's mainly them. I mainly use them for you. So it's like I have an invoices one, and that's only because, like, every year when the accounts come round, you go, I need the invoice for the things that were set up in my name through my account that need to go to you. And it's like, and I go, oh shit, and here's what I actually do. And then I type in invoice into my full inbox and then I drag them there. I don't do it as I go along. There's a handful. There's probably one. There's still one that's called Couch Corner, which is from the very early days of Redmond when Darren Farley used to come in and he used to answer people's agony answer things. Can't imagine where I got the idea for that from for this podcast. Go on, how many have you got?
Maybe 50 different folders for all the different things that we do. Yeah. But then I can find stuff, so it does help.
Mm. I can find stuff too. It's called the search bar.
It's not the same.
But it fundamentally ends up the same if you end up with 100 or 200 or whatever emails inside a subfolder and then you're having to use the search bar to find it in that.
No, you don't.
It's so just, do you delete them out of the subfolder?
Once they're used, they're done. They're, you know, I'm not going to go into the intricacies of my folders because you're
intricate filing system.
Okay? So we won't go into the intricacies. We'll just leave it there.
It's you and you go like, I've got all my emails to sort. I'm like, that's not a thing. How is that a thing for you? You're like, I've got to spend the day sorting my email. It's like, I would have to dedicate a significant portion of my life. You could put the amount of time you could weigh it against other things. Like, you could watch the entirety of Game of Thrones from start to finish in the time it would take me probably to sort my emails out. Probably more, to be perfectly honest.
The other thing that's been doing my head in, and I know we're only supposed to do one, but it's the first time that this has ever happened to me, Paul, is that Robin got given some school... No, Robin... That's never happened, Paul, and it never will. Robin's got given some school homework to do over the Easter holidays. She's in fucking reception, by the way. And they gave her this big folder, and I thought, oh, that'll be dead easy. We'll just sort that on, like, Easter Monday or something. And luckily, I opened it up on Easter Sunday, and I realised how much work we had to do. And we basically spent 3 hours Easter Sunday doing it and then had to leave my mum's early on Easter Monday to then come back and finish her homework for her. And it had, like, a diary and it had all these type of phonics things with the sounds from the middle of the word. One of them was pointing at a plane, right? Yeah. And the sound was E.T.
Yeah.
Right, and that's, to me and you, that's easy as a jet. To a four-year-old who's never called it a jet in her life. Oh my word, it was hard. It was hard graph. But the diary, I blagged it. What it did was, she had this fucking like 12-page diary to do, and I was like, that is going to take a long time.
She's four?
I know, and it has about 6 words that she can spell.
One of them being her own name.
Yeah, and the other three of those are the 12. Oh yeah, and so we went to a lot of places and stuff. So what I ended up doing was printing a load of pictures out and essentially filling half the book with pictures, so that then when Robin was asked by the teacher what she did, she didn't have to read what she'd written in case the words weren't something that she'd automatically know. She could look at the picture and blag the teacher. So essentially I spent a weekend blagging a four-year-old's homework for her.
I mean, I've done not to that level, because like when they say you take like the class teddy bear home and it's like print off pictures of what it's done. It's like a fucking printer, great. I've got something that amounts to a printer somewhere in a box in ours, but that's worky. So I know you've got a printer, and fair play, lots of people do have printers, but I'm printing pictures off and cutting them off. Nah, you're all right, mate, I'm not going to be doing that. I'll make them draw something. But so Jack's got, he's seven and he's got his SATs coming up. They have SATs, apparently.
At 7 years old.
Now, this is the thing. We've been told not to get into politics, but there's a degree to which, I am almost prepared to throw my entire political weight behind the Labour Party solely because Jeremy Corbyn came out this week and said, we're going to fuck SATs off. We're going to just fuck SATs off for under a certain age. Year 9, don't mind it, because it's about really, that's when you're really getting sorted into the proper, genuine morons and really, really, and really, really bright people. It makes a big difference when you get to senior school level. 7. We got under this book and it's like basically his teacher seems like a lovely lad, but he's a brand new first year teacher and he looks like he's a massive shit house, and he's panicking about his life and his role. So he's just putting it all on us, like we're bad horrible parents for not working through what amounts to the war and peace of homeworks over the Easter period. Nah, it's all right, I'm gonna take him to the park, thanks, and we'll let it worry out. My wife's stressing about it. Gotta make sure he gets good sleep in the week that he's got his SATs. He's fucking 7 years old.
It's too young, isn't it?
It's ridiculous. It's fucking ridiculous. And I blame his teacher.
Well, let's get on to some of the news and stuff then. Let's talk about Game of Thrones first and foremost. And one thing that I think we picked up on last week.
Time codes.
It's timestamps, yeah. So we've got Ty getting the timestamps and stuff there. So if you want to miss out the Game of Thrones chat, you can go to the next one. I thought it was an incredible episode, Paul. I think it's setting up probably the biggest fight in TV history in the next episode, which will be, yep, I'd guess, the Battle of Winterfell.
Sure. It's, I was really pleased with it. And it's when you realise halfway through the episode that there's not that many episodes, so there can be no more drawing it out or fanning about it. I'm a big fan of Dragon Ball, where a fight where the universe is about to collapse in 30 seconds and it takes 5 episodes to do it. So I'm all for that kind of drawn out storytelling, but clearly they're like, it's going to be by next light. Oh, amazing. The disappointment came, of course, that it's all ready to go off and then the episode ends and it's like,
But I was so happy with that. I like that. I like set up episodes when they're done well.
Yeah, but also I live in box set culture. I'm now just wishing I'd just swerved it for two months and just watched the whole.
But it's supposed to be the longest episode of Game of Thrones ever. Mm. So you're probably talking an hour and 10, hour and 15, hour and 20 minutes long. It's going to be a massive battle, isn't it?
Yeah.
On the scale of Lord of the Rings type battles, as well.
Can we talk about what was the best moment and what's led to one of the best memes that I've seen in the aftermath to it? Giant's Milk.
Yeah.
Giant's Milk. And obviously there's a picture of him and you can buy it. It's made as an advert for Giant's Milk, effectively. It just one of those lines of looking somewhat deeply in the eye and saying, Giant's Milk, I sucked at a tits for three months, and it, Giant's Milk, it made me strong. Wow, someone should do that with milk. Just try that in a bar. Don't get bevied. Get yourself a pint of milk and basically say, milk, calcium, makes me the strong, powerful man that I am, and then maintain eye contact with a bird while swinging an entire pint of ice cold milk off. If someone does that, then let me know.
It was an incredible scene, and he was actually the only sort of comedic character in the episode, wasn't he? He was the one that kind of broke it. There was a few times during the episode where you laugh for a few seconds, and then oh yeah, they're all gonna die at some point here. But that fireplace scene, Paul. They had I've written them down here. They had Brienne of Tarth, or just the big lady, Tyrion, Pod, Giants Bane, Kingslayer, and Davos. I want to ask you, who's going to survive from that round the fireplace chat? If anyone.
Tyrion.
Tyrion.
And that's it. I like the way they've set, they just subtly set Pod up as like he's going to be able to hold his own all of a sudden. Because let's be honest, prior to that bit where he's just all of a sudden capable of fighting and it's dead easy for him, he was dying in 3 seconds, wasn't he? So at least it gives him the opportunity. He's probably going to do something. I wonder whether that's a bit on the nose that you might think, ooh, look, he might survive here. And then, nah. But as I've said, ultimately, with my predictions last week, I can't see a world where everyone you know and love doesn't die in this series. So if you've got any shred of feeling towards any of these characters, unlucky, because you're getting ready.
So I've got Brienne of Tarth is about to get killed and Giantsbane comes in and saves her.
Mm-hmm.
As he's dying, he realises that he saved her, and that's absolutely cool. But then as soon as he's dead, Brienne dies anyway. Uh-huh. She just gets killed off anyway, so that was all for now.
Okay.
And then Kingslayer's a goner. Davos, there's been all this talk of how, for the last, two episodes probably, is that I can't fight and yet I've survived these battles. Yeah. Well, I'm sorry, then you're dying in this one.
Yeah.
Tyrion, I actually think, is going to die. And Pod is probably going to die as well, so I'm going to say that none of them survive from in this fireplace
in this battle. So none of them gets to go. None of them gets to see Cersei again, and none of them.
Not in this battle, because I think what happens after Winterfell is they all retreat to King's Landing at some point in the next few episodes, and there's another big.
Oh well,
fight
in that
there.
Instance, yeah. Well, okay. Well, who's dying in the Battle of Winterfell?
Okay, Davos,
probably.
Giantsbane,
maybe.
Pod,
probably.
And Brienne.
Okay.
So
Tyrion, she's been given a heroic moment,
Tyrion,
she, maybe.
And Kingslayer survive to go back to King's Landing.
Yeah, because no, because
then Cersei might just kill them.
Well,
anyway.
They've sent Robson Green down to kill them, haven't they? So there's no way you don't set that up without the having. So they're safe for now. Can we just draw attention to before we move on from the Game of Thrones stuff? Like, could they have set up any better? Everyone in the crypt dying.
No.
Like,
not really.
It couldn't have been any more signposted and blatant. If they just had like some sort of completely out of place neon pointing arrow that says death lies down in the crypt,
the thing that interests me about that is there's loads of dead bodies down there. So you just need a white to get down there, raise all the dead Starks, and then everyone's fucked.
Ooh.
One white needs to get down there. That's it.
Yeah. It's gonna happen.
That
everyone.
Could be interesting. Could you then see a headless Ned Stark flying around and killing people,
holding his head and hobbling like is ultimately what I think will happen then is that everyone's set up for this massive mega battle. They've got the plan where they're going to try and get the Night King, blah blah blah. The dead end up coming out from inside of Winterfell gets over and all the people in there die. Maybe Sam, is it
Sam Tarly,
maybe he sacrifices himself to save some, you know, a couple of people, like the girls or whatever, and then they have to disband and fucking leg it, basically, so you don't get maybe quite the big epic be-all and end-all battle that we thought it was all.
The other thing that's interesting is the Brand's obviously being set up as the bait here. Mm-hmm. That's not going to work. That's not going to work well at all.
It's too early, yeah.
It's ridiculous. It's just a stupid idea. It's a gambling man's way of winning a war, that, isn't it? That's what they're doing. And basically, I think that you know, the Night King is going to kill them all off there. Okay. So we'll end the Game of Thrones chat there. We'll come back to that next week, of course. You wanted to talk about the fallout from City Spares.
Yeah, we're a week on from it. So, you know, we've all had time to live in that world. We've had a time to live in the VAR madness world for a bit. And I don't want to get into the VAR stuff at all because it's a whole other day worth of discussion. But I loved the stuff that came off the back of it. We didn't get a chance to do this because we recorded this before that. So I come to that. The two things that wound me up, there was the fella who left early and got caught on camera basically thinking that City had won.
I know you're very disappointed.
Very disappointed we won?
No, it's disallowed.
Was it?
Yeah.
What was he doing? What goes
beating the traffic?
No, but exactly. But like, I love the fact that he just went, there we go, done and dusted. On we go. Here we go. Matching our way to semi-finals. No,
I'd love to see the full interview of that.
I would give anything.
The 3.5 minutes of them telling them why they are out.
Yeah, and I'm just sitting down on the floor and rocking for a bit. What a fucking idiot! Like, just grade A, massive knobhead. Like, it was like 30 seconds. I mean, don't get me wrong, a lot of those videos, like, you realise it's like 2 minutes is a long watch on Twitter, but I stuck it out, particularly that 360 degree video where you got to see the reaction of them and the heart all breaking and all that, which was just delicious. But the one that really got me, and look, bearing in mind we dedicated a section of the podcast last week to, you know, sometimes you can film stuff and you can make a mistake by putting it out there in the public, but there are just some things that I think are massive alarm bells, and they are: if you record your reactions, if you're holding a camera and recording your facial reactions to a football match, and then something goes horrendously wrong in that football match.
We're out.
Delete. Or, best case scenario is you leave it on your phone until your phone goes out of date and it stays in a drawer for the rest of eternity. And maybe in some sort of nostalgic thing about 10 years from now, you find that wire and you get it, go, oh, fucking hell, there was me at that. That video, because there's a kid who's done it, and he's a young lad, and I don't know where he's from, whatever. He's a Man City fan, clearly. Why, who's put that out? Has he put that out? Has someone robbed it off him? Is that like, because that's like, I would almost rather have a fucking sex tape leak than me reacting to Liverpool and like a heartbreaking Liverpool moment. I'd rather be. Well, Dele Alli was a shit sex tape, wasn't it? But I would almost rather have a leaked sex tape where I'm being dominated by someone really uncool. You know what I mean? Than film that and have that be that be put out there. Like, find it.
Ali, we do it in Redmen all the time, don't we? We film stuff, but we just don't bother putting it out when we lose. Yeah. You know, those story, the matches, they never go anywhere because you're not making content for us. At that point, you're making content for someone else, not Liverpool fans.
I can only imagine, I think I saw a journalist reacting to it this way and saying, like, I can only imagine, like, it's because that kid has now got the attention that he was seeking with that, because look, we're now talking about it and people have talked about it, whatever. Just weird. Just, I don't know, it's a culture I don't like about it. Look, I film at football matches, I do. Occasionally I put my face in it, but it's normally just me going, and then move on, mainly so that when I look at it in years to come, I can remind myself that I was there, and also, you know, for the thumbnail. I've never understood. I find it really uncomfortable. I found selfie camera. Whenever I accidentally turn the camera on my phone, it's facing me, like, I get...
We'll get that.
Yeah, horrendous. So the idea of being stood there looking at it for that time, not for me. And the last thing is the VAR caps. I am a big fan of entrepreneurial spirit, and I kind of love the VAR cap. It's very much got a small place and moment in time, but someone's had the wherewithal to do that. Someone's made an absolute ton of cash this week, and then they'll move on to the next thing.
Yeah, absolutely agree with that. I love the fact that they've done the VAR caps. I don't like the fact that the kid was recording himself. I love the fact that the fella left early. That should be, everyone should take up, you know, stand up and take notice of that, because that's what happens when you leave football games early. For what? Like, I don't get it. Like, there are people, and I go to the game with someone, James, and if he's watching now, he won't mind me saying this. He travels up from London, and there are times when he has to leave early to get a train. Yeah. And that, I can understand. He's leaving. Tottenham game, he left 15 minutes before the end, and he was at home baked when Liverpool scored the winner. And he had that moment, and he told me next time I met him, he's like, I almost ran back to see if I could get back into the ground, but it was too late.
Yeah.
He was at home baked. But he's got he travels 2.5 hours to get up for the game. He can't even watch the full game, and he travels 2.5 back.
Yeah.
I get that. But I used to go to footy with my dad's mates when I was younger, and we'd be leaving 15 minutes before the end just to beat the traffic.
Yeah, my dad always said, like, he'd go halfway into, like, injury time. So if there was 4 minutes injury time, you'd wait two and then get off. Unless, but, like, never in that circumstance, ever. Ever, 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 because these are once-in-a-lifetime things. Everything changes. Until the final whistle's blown, you're not going to know whether it's done and dusted, and you want to stay and see, soak it up a little bit, like, you know. So yeah, my issue with that, and I know James, and I like James, and is that it's not for me, you know. I don't think I'd bother going, you know. I wouldn't if I had to leave before the end of a game. I'm not really at the game. I'd rather be in a situation where I could watch the full the full match. I'd almost rather be in a pub watching it than not be able to watch the full thing. But the getting off early thing's always done my head in, because, you know, we fell foul of it as a kid. A couple of times as a kid, I remember missing an equalising goal. I think Emil Heskey scored one, and we were in the car park outside the Centenary at the time. We'd actually be like, oh, shit. Because, look, that's the gamble. You pay, you know, you take your chances. But in that situation, it's wonderful, delicious irony, and the guy got everything he deserved. Yeah.
So one of the things I wanted to talk about, and it's actually a little bit about Manchester United and Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. We're filming this before the Manchester United Man City game. We're not going to talk about that at all, Paul. But I wanted to have a conversation with someone about, should he be worried for his job at some point soon?
I've just spent, just randomly, I was watching one of the post-match shows. I was watching Gary Neville's post-match reaction to the Everton game on Sky, and then it bled into James Richardson and James Horncastle and John Northcroft on the Premier League TV show or whatever, talking about the aftermath and blah blah blah. They are all, I think, I say all because you can't tarnish a whole fan base with one brush or whatever. I think they've put the managerial thing to one side. Even the mainstream journalists are not, no one's questioning, because it's been too soon. He hasn't had a chance to put his blah 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 blah, and he did such a great job when he came in that I think he's just built up enough bank of things, and they're talking about him being this, getting back to the old way of United, etc, etc. People are now talking about the Glazers again, which I think for United is important, because that's always been the issue. They were just a bit blinded to, because when you're getting success on the pitch, you tend not to care about all the other things all of a sudden. So I think Solskjaer's job is safe, but I think obviously we don't know how the City game's gone. I think if they've been absolutely tonked in that, you might start to get a few dissenters.
I know that Manchester United haven't scored a goal in four of their last eight games. Mm. I know that Manchester United haven't scored a goal from open play in 437 minutes of football.
Why do you know that?
Because I read an article on it this morning.
That's okay.
Yeah. Right. And I know that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer was given the job probably, and I'm guessing this, actually, I don't know, probably off the back of them, the Woodward making a commercial decision over a footballing decision, because they should have just waited until the end of the year. Mm-hmm. There was no need to give him the job at the time that they gave him the job, other than a bit of fan pressure or something like that. I've heard that Manchester United are now running almost a skeleton's crew, and I think that Manchester United will be on the selling block, is what I'm reading into that.
Right.
So the Glazers, I believe that, you know, when the fans stop talking about the manager, like you say, they'll start talking about Woodward, and what Woodward's done over the last few years is he's managed to deflect the talk from the Glazers onto other people, Mourinho being one of them, players and stuff like that. They've now cut the cost. Manchester United now, I think I'm right in saying, the most profitable football club in the world. Again, this has all happened under the Glazers, but they're obviously servicing a massive debt. Mm. That says to me that Manchester United will probably be up for sale. It doesn't look like they're building to compete at the top of the Premier League. It looks like they're trying to pad the numbers out to make it more profitable, to make a big sale. And I think Ole Gunnar Solskjaer shouldn't be worried until at least Christmas. Mm. If they start next season poorly, then I think he should be worried. And it's mad because I think we're still in David Moyes' original contract there.
Yeah, I know. I don't think there's a chance in hell Solskjaer finishes next season as the United manager. And I said that before the day he was announced as caretaker manager this season. I'm starting more and more, though, to see this very slight possibility. Sir Alex Ferguson as caretaker manager next season, just to steady the ship or whatever for a bit. He's hanging round. He's already, because he's getting more and more involved. You know what I mean? All the talk about him, you know, offering advice and all that, he's being called on more and more. And I wonder whether he just gets tempted, just like put a little toe in the water to just come out for the end of the season. They're waiting on a manager, for example, and he just gets tempted to come out. What I love about the Solskjaer stuff is, I love about the Man United stuff is, as a Liverpool fan, is watching them fall into all the same pitfalls that we've been falling into for the last 30 years. And I see, Solskjaer was apparently taking them to the cliff, which is their old training facility ahead of that game. And it's like, so apparently they've been upkept reasonably, but he's taken them to these
outdated, outmoded, you know, facilities that you know United built Carrington because it wasn't good enough what they had initially. But he's playing on this nostalgia factor, and that's how he got he got everyone up and running, he got all the fans on behind because like, oh look, it's Ollie's at the wheel, all the old songs, understands the club, he's got the connection to Sir Alex Ferguson, he remembers what it was like when United won the treble, when they're at their absolute best, and now it's so Brendan Rodgers. It's unbelievable. It's Brendan bringing back the old This Is Anfield sign. Yeah. It's Brendan bringing back the red nets. It's trying to foster this nostalgic feeling rather than building something in the here and now that's new, but like has it, you know, because the Liverpool way is just basically winning football matches. Ultimately, how you go about achieving them, as long as you win more loads and loads and loads of football matches and win silverware, that's basically the Liverpool way. Pass the ball a little bit. And I think he's trying to buy himself time by trading in on like everyone's warm, fuzzy feelings of the past. And I think it's absolutely...
It's not. I don't think it's good. I mean, I must admit, I thought it would work, and I thought next season United might be decent. I thought they'd be definitely top four next season. That was only like 3 weeks ago, probably the last time I thought like that. Mm. And watching the way that they've sort of capitulated, most recently, of course, against Everton and stuff. And now I'm thinking to myself, this fella hasn't got a fucking clue. Mm. It's all good trying to do it Fergie's way, but you're not Ferguson. And that's the difference. Mm. Ferguson was one of the best managers that's ever lived. And you're Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, they got Cardiff relegated, but
honestly, it's like deal or no deal management. It's like going, oh, Pogba, you're not performing. Oh, I'll get Sir Alex on the phone. You know, I do with my kids all the time. Oh, do you want me to ring your teacher? Do you want me to ring your teacher? Oh, do you want me to ring your nana? Oh, nana will come down and sort you out. It's like, I'm dialing the number. I'm dialing it. And it's like, oh my God, just either make Ferguson the manager again or just do something.
Like, he's not even parking in the manager's spot, is he?
Apparently, no, because he's like, that's the gaffer spot.
I'm sorry, mate, grow a pair of fucking balls from me to you. You're the manager of Manchester United, not Sir Alex Ferguson. Give him another spot. Give him the Sir Alex Ferguson spot. You're the fucking manager. Go and fucking park in your own spot, you absolute divvy.
Gang of weirdos, honestly. Anyway.
Last one. You want to talk about Shane Long?
Shane Long's got the fastest Premier League goal in history. Mm. Shane Long, everyone. Shane Long, who hadn't scored a goal this season until he scored against us, and then scored the fastest, or 7 seconds fastest Premier League. Have you seen it?
Yeah.
It's hilarious.
It's a good finish.
I always wonder whenever you watch those fastest goals, because there's only so many ways in which it can happen from the kickoff. And I wasn't expecting it to be that. It took me. I hadn't figured out.
Same here. I was thinking, how are they going to get this ball to Shane Long?
Yeah, I couldn't quite figure out who. It took me that long basically to just go, okay, that's Southampton. Yeah, and that's it. And then, he's in. And there he is. And he scored. Okay, brilliant. I love that. I love the fact that Shane Long. I like Shane Long. I think he's actually a decent player. He's not a great goal scorer, but I love the fact that it's basically, that's probably never going to get broken unless someone scores directly from it, you know, as a dig straight from the kickoff at some point. I like the fact that random, weird, not very good players hold mad records in big divisions. I think that's a proper throwback.
That's enough of talking about Shane Long for me, to be honest with you, Paul. That's far too much. I didn't ever think we'd discuss Shane Long on this podcast. We're two episodes in.
Told you.
There's not been a Buffy reference.
Expected.
Yet we've talked about Shane Long.
Mm. Expect.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Unexpected, what can I say?
Right. Last week we talked a little bit about obviously the Rent Boys stuff and how it affected me. And this week I wanted to talk about something from your past. One of the comments that we had from William Andreasen last week was, sometimes you guys, who I love by the way, talk about your life before Redmen. For example, you talk about the restaurant. Could you tell us more about that? Give us your history, your story pre-Redmen. You'll never walk alone. Excuse me.
can we just drop a little like and send some hearts in the comments for Chris, by the way, who is suffering more than any man should have to suffer, and also he's not well.
Yeah, it's true. I'm sweating under these lights as well, you know.
You're burning all out.
I need some makeup.
Spare a thought for me and Si.
I've just locked in the lights.
Yeah, spare a thought for me and Si, who are in an enclosed, hermetically sealed room with Chris, who is the sickest man on earth, and not like you're a sick MC.
No, I am. I'm not. So let's talk about pre-Redmen then. Let's talk a little bit about your job history first and foremost before we dive into the topic that I want to talk about. So you've got a degree at university.
Just about.
And then you came back to Liverpool. Yeah. You stayed in Sheffield for a bit actually.
No, I finished uni and I was so certain that I'd failed my degree that I was like, I can't come back to Liverpool. I can't come back to Liverpool with me sort of tail between my legs, so I need to get a job. So I was working in a pub at the time and I kind of worked my way up the chain there a little bit to be like assistant manager. So I did that and I stuck around and I, you know, made a life in Sheffield at this point and a house and that I was renting and what have you. So yeah, I did that and then I don't even know, in fact, no, I'll tell you what it was. It was on a whim. It was the Champions League run of 2004-2005 for Liverpool, and we beat Leverkusen in the first leg of like the round of 16 or the quarters or whatever it was, and something happened around that and I was like, I just can't, I'm bored of being here, I need to be back in Liverpool, this is clearly where it's all going, it's time to go and reclaim my life and recapture it and all this kind of stuff, and I'm going to move back and I'm going to make films and I'm going to do all this.
Were you going pretty serious with a girl at this point? Where did that fit in?
At the time...
Were you engaged to her?
No, God, no. No, not at all. this time, no, I was... This is me enjoying the spell of time where I was young and living, and basically living above a pub and had access to beer and lock-ins and taking advantage of all the glorious things that come with having a building full of girls who want to stay and have a drink with you kind of thing. Like, so no, I very much was single at the time. And then... Yeah, just on a whim, move back to Liverpool, and yeah, I expected it all to be like to naturally follow. Well, I've got my degree ultimately, and I've got all these ideas. I've got a notebook full of ideas. I'm gonna get a bank loan, and I'm gonna buy a camera, and I'm just gonna start filming them. And I got turned down for the bank loan because I'd fucked my credit up by just getting my overdraft over the top and having a credit card that I didn't pay, and blah blah blah. And I ended up back in Liverpool on the dole, living in my mum and dad's house, and just, you know, living hand to mouth instead. So yeah, not quite the success I was hoping for.
So once you realised that you weren't going to make a success of it, then what did you then turn to? Did you go back into pubs then?
So yeah, so that was when I was,
because it's hard for me because it's, well, we're talking probably 15 years ago.
Yeah, pretty much.
So the timescale alone, I obviously knew you and was there and a big part of all this. The timescale just doesn't match up in my head. Where did British Gas fit in?
So God, let me work it out. I moved back to Liverpool and I got...
Because you were an estate agent at some point down there as well.
I was an estate agent at a point of that. Yeah, so basically, let me work this out. So we won the European Cup in 2005 and that was like the greatest summer of all time, and it was like England won the Ashes and all kinds, and I just kind of floated around doing odds and sods. So I worked for the estate agent for a bit over that summer, doing like just randomly walking the streets, looking for other agencies' boards and noting them on a map. And that was fine because it was just, I was out in the fresh air and what have you, and driving around and listening to Don't Believe the Truth by Oasis. Was out
what were you
time.
Listening on?
On a portable CD player.
Amazing.
Like, yeah, absolutely. And they
were fucking shit, weren't they?
Yeah,
they were the worst.
Unless they had a really good like buffer, that, so you know, because if you got really shit ones, you literally had to carry them.
Yeah, like that.
This. So yeah, away for that, and then I got a job at British Gas selling gas and Alechi door to door, and I remember getting and being like dead made up for myself, and we did like a month's training in Manchester, and it was great, and I was flying. This was like, this is incredible. And then the real job started, and it's like you've got to drive to a location in like Ormskirk, for an example, and there's a gang of lads all in the British Gas coats and the British Gas uniforms with the badges and all that, and you get handed what was called like a knock sheet, and it just had a list of addresses, the people's names that they once knew lived there, and an idea of whether they had certain products or whatever, and you just had to fucking knock on doors, and everyone's existed in this world, and everyone's had these absolute knobheads turn up on the doorstep, and that was me.
Did you enjoy people slamming the door in your face?
It's one of the most, like, there's some more degrading jobs you can do. I'm sure if you were like a jizz mopper at a porn theatre or something, that would be pretty degrading, but it wasn't far from that. It was just, because you just, for a start, you've got this information, so you've got people's names. Nobody likes that. Nobody likes unsolicited people turning up on the door and going, "Hiya, Mrs. Jameson." And they're like, "Who are you and why do you know my name?" "Don't worry, miss, I'm with British Gas, blah blah blah." And they're just basically like, "Okay, that's great, fuck off." And having, you know, because it's sales, but sales is a horrible job to do at the best of times, but doing it where you are effectively doorstepping people is just, they had like terms for it about not letting negativity in and how to keep yourself in a positive mindset and all that kind of thing. And,
I think that's what everyone was doing to you, wasn't it?
Honestly, yeah. But we did training in neuro-linguistic programming about how you kind of get into people's heads, which is just, when you get it, people will know it, but when you get into that world, it's disgusting that kind of thing exists, about like basically trying to trick people into liking you and getting through it. But I work with a couple of nice people, but some of the biggest arseholes I've ever worked with in my life, because you're on commission, and there's just people out there. I trained under a guy who was the head of the union, and he was earning 70 grand a year selling gas and Lecky on the door, and his number two was earning 50 grand, and they were both just fucking liars, horrible scumbag liars, and they'd ask for, in their expression, only have sheets in low dem areas, and that was basically former council flats. And they'd go in and they had some lie about how, because all the meters had British Gas on them from when it was nationalised, they'd say, "Well, that's a British Gas meter," and this other company's come in and they've put this standing charge on there. "If you go back to British Gas, we'll take that off you, so you'll save this money and we'll be able to blah, 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 blah." Just complete and utter horseshit. And they'd basically prey on people who were more vulnerable, older people, and people who weren't educated enough to be able to know better, and they would absolutely rinse it, and it was just, yeah. one of the you go home feeling dirty at the end of the night because, and they'd be going home fucking in the boss cars laughing their tits off. Yeah,
that they just essentially robbed someone.
But we were, there was one story when we went into this, it was in Norris Green, and I like, everyone knows Norris Green, it's like in Liverpool, it's not quite a rough area, it's where my dad and my nan and grandad and all that and that are from. So I grew up in my early years around there, and we got into this house, and it was basically someone's nan, and he got in, and we signed up to all these things, and they loved it. They made us a cup of tea, and they were absolutely made up, and we got onto the street afterwards, and we got out of earshot basically. I went, "Oh, we did a really good thing there." He went, yeah, "Just put the gas and Lecky up by £50 a month, but you know what, we've got all three, so I'll get a bonus for that." And it was like, that could have been like my grandparents, so it could have been whatever. No, and that was when I was like, I mean, also because it was a shit job and I was dead lazy and I just wanted to go off and hang out with my mates in the daytime. I watched several films, but I was also technically on the books there. But yeah, it was full of dickheads and school.
Yeah, we've got some nice photos of you, I think, in that British Gas coat, haven't we?
I love that. To be fair, I actually genuinely loved that. I loved that jacket. I had a waterproof waterproof British Gas coat, which it was the one thing that I robbed because it was a really nice jacket. But yeah,
do you remember the photos that I'm talking about?
Oh, from my stag do.
Yeah. So we went gorge walking on Paul's stag do.
Yeah.
Now Paul loves many things. Paul is not one of those guys who likes the outside.
I know, completely not true. I love the outside. I love being outside. The active venture sort of lifestyle, I find fucking weird. Like people who climb mountains for a living. I mean, to be fair, some of it comes from like my uncle was a mountain climber and died climbing Mont Blanc. I fucking detest that kind of thing, and I don't like those kind of people because people who thrill seek. It's like, great, your lives are so empty that you need to thrill seek. And then what happens when it goes wrong? Oh no, you might get like respect in your community, but you've basically just robbed your family of you. Because what? Because you couldn't get fucking thrill out of having a normal life.
So we weren't exactly, I wouldn't say we were thrill seeking as such. It was gorge walking, so it was very easy. And that's what we decided to do on your stag. I say we, I decided with our mates because we thought Paul would hate it. And yeah, we were right, Paul absolutely hated every second of it. But you wore this British gas jacket, Paul, and we had to get into streams. And this British gas jacket was brilliant because A, it was waterproof, fantastic.
It was waterproof both ways, yeah.
But it also had ginormous, maybe 5 litre pockets.
Yeah, basically. Right? Like, yeah.
And he got into the water and he filled up and were dragging you down at this point, weren't they?
It was there was a list of like instructions of like what your clothing should be, and it in that was like a waterproof jacket. So yeah, no problem. No, and it was like, and then I was like, why is this so hard? And effectively, because the pockets were waterproof in both directions, so like, yeah, you know, rain on them, it was going to keep water, keep your things dry, but if you were to literally fill them with water, the water would remain in said pockets.
And you had your life jacket on strapped over the top of the coat, so there was no way you could just take your coat off. Or
yeah,
was there?
Yeah, it was a tactical wrong decision made, as opposed to like was something I wasn't in the mood for, something I didn't need to. I was horrendously hungover. And it was funny because it starts off and it was like, and this girl's run, she's like, who's the stag? And it's like, me. Well, come and stand by the end of this jetty. And I was like, are you gonna push me in the water? And she was like, yeah. And I was like, yeah, no, I'll just jump in the water, thanks. And she was like, oh, okay. I was like, okay, this is boss, isn't it? Yeah,
you absolutely hated it.
Oh god, yeah, it was terrible.
Yeah, we all loved it.
We went go karting afterwards, and that was much better.
It was much better, to be fair, but it was so fun. So let's go back onto your history. Let's skip forward a little bit. You're working as an assistant manager in a pub on Allerton Road. You were fired, and this is kind of where the crux of this conversation I wanted to get to.
Yeah,
I think there'll be a lot of people probably who've been in this situation before and have dealt with it differently. How did getting fired from a job affect you at that time of your life?
It's so weird because it ended up being, it was like it moved into probably the hardest period of my life at that time, because it was a weird set of circumstances. I loved working in pubs and I loved working in bars because I've always been a bit of an extrovert. Certainly was when I got into my teenage years. I wasn't really before that, but I loved the conversation, I loved the chat, I loved the banter. I thought of it always a bit of a stage. I always thought of it as like everything within those four walls was mine. I'd have a laugh and I'd go and I'd speak to everyone, and I just was just a really, really outgoing person. And I genuinely loved it, even though, you know, it's a crap job working behind the bar, but it suited me and my lifestyle and my personality and all that stuff at that time. And then to then lose the job, and it kind of went in circumstances where I actually really liked the people that I worked for as well at the time. Like it was independently owned, and it was a family of characters, but like I was at the time close with all of them. The dad was the owner, and I had a real respect for him. And then circumstances kind of conspired, and for whatever reason, I'll never know the mindset behind it, but a situation was engineered that was used to force me out, and it totally basically fucking cut the legs from under me. And it was a weird sense of self-worth that goes with, you know, and a self-confidence that was just, I don't know, it was weirdly taken away from me. And then I had that spell where I had to go through tribunal and all that kind of stuff that followed. So it was months and months of not being able to get a job, because when you're going into these other similar kind of jobs, people are going, well, why aren't you working? It's like, well, I'm currently in an industrial tribunal, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, yeah, all right.
Big fucking red light.
Exactly. Won't be touching you. Whether, you know, and then when you ever find in life when you have to over-explain a story or a situation, it never sounds convincing, does it? And let's be honest, there's a bazillion people all going for those kind of jobs. You're going to take the one who's got some sort of potentially dodgy history or whatever. Confidence-wise.
How old were you at this point again?
I'd have been, this was like 2007, just the start of 2007, I think. Yeah, I think that's right. So it was like January 2007. It was around my birthday.
25-ish, something like that.
Yeah, 24,
24 I'd have been just then, like, so entering the prime years and whatever. And, you know, throughout this time I'd spent loads of time, I'd started to do little videos and little bits and pieces and stuff just to kind of keep myself ticking over. But like that I don't know what it's hard to explain because it sounds like nothing, but when you go from when something blindsides you like that, and you don't see it coming, and when you're kind of singularly driven vision, you're totally bought into yourself, maybe a bit up yourself or whatever at the time, and then you think like everything's going well and you're liked and you're secure. When that gets taken from you, it's like having something part of you ripped out of you, and I found it very, very difficult. And then all of a sudden, you know, again, I'm back on the dole. I'm in my mum and dad's. I'm struggling to make ends meet. I'd bought this car when I got the British Gas job. I couldn't afford to make payments and all this kind of stuff on it. And so I ended up back at like effectively square one with no prospects, no money, and not being able to do anything about it. So yeah, it was.
So how long were you on the dole for?
It was probably. It was months, like, it was...
I remember taking you down there was it Thursday or Tuesday morning?
It was every couple of weeks, I think it was, you had to go down. Like, I do remember. I remember when I signed on, because it was like a couple of weeks after I got sacked, and I had a little bit of, like, your remaining wages or whatever, and I just went out on a massive bender for a fortnight. And basically I ended up back in Sheffield, but out with my mates, and then I was absolutely ruined. And I came back and I had to sign on like the Monday morning or whatever, and I had no voice. I was just an absolute shell wreck of a man. And the guy interviewing me went, yeah, like, are you all right? I was like, yeah. And he went, right, listen, goes around, pulls his drawer, pulls his piece of paper out and slides it across the desk to him, and he goes, this might help you get some more benefits here. And it was like a declaration, I am a recovering drink or drug abuser. I was like, I'm not signing that. So I signed on around then, and it was probably within that year, probably the vast majority, I think, certainly all that summer, I think I struggled to get back into
it. How did it affect your relationship with your mum and dad?
That was, it's tough because you go back in, everyone has this if you ever go away to university or you go away, whether you're 18 or not, you're grown up, you're an adult, and you get to set your own rules and your own boundaries and you've got your own life. And it was weird being back anyway, even though I was working and I was earning money, it put a strain on the relationship because I was basically living the other 12 hours of the day. But then when you go back to it and all of a sudden you're in your mid-20s, you're unemployed, you can't then contribute towards rent, and then... You know, it puts a strain because you can't be an adult. You effectively regress to being a kid because you are at the mercy. And I'm lucky, you know, this is not a sob story because, you know, I'm lucky the moment that I were able to, they still had a bedroom for me, that they could still put food on the table for me, et cetera, et cetera. But again, as far as like wanting to be this outgoing, effervescent adult who's ready to conquer the world, you know, like I said, I moved back to Liverpool with the intent of making me name and fame and fortune and being the next, you know, Edgar Wright or being the next Steven Spielberg, etc. And a year on, and I'm living in my mum and dad's living off 50 quid a week or whatever it was, 88 quid a fortnight, I think it was at the time. You know, my mum and dad had always had a very close relationship, but it's like having, for them, you got another adult living in your house who's steadfast in their belief of ways and blah blah blah. Yeah, it meant it was tense, I think, at best, and it meant that I just was desperate to just not be in the house. So you end up out at mates' houses and you end up sleeping on couches and you end up sleeping on floors and you end up doing whatever and getting up at waking up at midday and then staying in that house and staying out for days. So yeah, I was a fucking mess around that time.
So what? When did you come out the other side?
So it's interesting because the real bonus that comes out of it, and it ended up being the thing that turned my life around at the same time, was the weeks after losing my job, we were out in town on this mega bender, and I actually met my now wife out at that time, and that was like, she was the one who ended up kind of starting to put me on the straight and narrow to some extent, because all of a sudden, I had another place to be. I had another place I could go. I could go and be a bit more
grown up and more mature. She had a flat about 10-minute walk away from my mum and dad's, which is great, and we started to spend more and more time together. And then it became that, more and more, it became me spending time with her rather than maybe spending time with mates who weren't, let's say, the best influence at the time. We shared friends who they've all pretty much come out the other side of it now, and I think everyone has this of a certain age. You all, when you've got a group of mates, and then you're out and playing, you might be in parks, and then maybe you end up in one person's bedroom. And you're all there, and gradually everyone kind of moves away and gets on with their lives. And I was one of the last ones to sort of leave that room. You'd long since gone. You had a job. You were settled down. You were in a relationship. You'd been in a long term relationship around that time, and that was what slowly started to like pull me kicking and screaming out of being this absolute fucking
dickhead.
Well, dickhead, scumbag, like no ambition, no drive, whatever. And so, yeah, you know, and I got around that period, and then, you know, I got started working for you, and then had enough money to start putting some money in towards rent and moved in with me girlfriend, who became fiancée, who became wife, and that was the catalyst that kind of turned my life around, really.
So there you go, you just need a Charlie Machen to turn your life around. Yeah. It's that simple.
Oh, everyone needs it.
There you go. That's all it is.
No, but it's true. But there was a point in that, and I remember so many relationships that I had that totally fell to bits because the lure of being with my mates was more, and it was always like I could go to my girlfriend's house, but what are my mates doing? I don't want to miss out. I don't. What if they're doing something brilliant and something fun, and I'm sat here watching Corrie with a girl, and she was the first time where I was like, I'd rather just be with her. I remember one, we had a massive Barney, and I got out, and funnily enough, it's one of those things that like it wasn't necessarily in my hands, this, but I remember phoning my mates and not getting an answer, and it gave me like half an hour to stew on it, and I did, and I was like, you've been a dickhead there, and phoning her up, and then coming back and making up, and then like that ended up being, and it was funny that she cites that as a time when, in a normal relationship, that might have been the end of it, or I might have, you know, previous boyfriends would have walked away, and it ended up being like, yeah, again, like one of those moments that you look back on and go, if I in another time, another place, I'd have just gone to my mate's houses, reverted to type, and probably not ended up. Yeah, exactly.
It's mad, isn't it? So now we're going to go on to the final section of the show then. We're going to try and answer some tweets and stuff and comments from last week's YouTube video. They're all taken from last week's YouTube video. If you've not watched MXP number one, then do go and check that one out. But we'll start with Nick Miller. It won't be long until you guys are 50 years old. Hey, that's a topic where you guys talk about no longer being 18, basically getting old and how it's not bloody fair. Why do we have to get old and how fucking frustrating is it?
It's not, to be fair, it's still a while till we're 50. It's not long till we're 40. I'll be honest, like that. I'm not asked about being older. I'm asked about how much harder it gets to just be. Like, I've had bad knees since I was 13 or whatever. I've been in better health now than I probably have been over the last 10 years. But like the gym the other week, I've just hurt my knees again. I've exacerbated it, and now I can't. I'm like, hold on to the bats to go downstairs, and I'm thinking, this is not getting better. When I'm 50, 60, 70, I'm not going to be fine. This is not going to be a problem that goes away. It's a problem I've had for 20 years. It's not of 20 more than 20 years. It's not going to be, yeah. So it's all the little stupid things that you took for granted that now are loads more difficult. Picking things up off the floor, for example.
For me, it's just shit. All of it's just shit, Paul, because it's all the stuff that you've just mentioned there. It's your knees, it's your back. Sometimes my back can just be bad. Like, that's something that an old person says. It's my back. It's like fucking hell. The amount of times I have to say that I can't pick you up, my back. Yeah. I mean, that's ridiculous. I'm basically turning into my mum and my dad. Yeah. But then that's the other thing, that getting old, why it's shit. Because all of a sudden, you look at your mum and dad and you look at them in a different light when you get to a certain age. So I don't know whether it was like I was maybe 30. And you know what it was, right? I was 32, I think, when Robin was born, our first. And that was the same age as my mum and dad. And my mum, I think, was 32 when she had me, or my dad, one of the two. It'd be easy for me to work out, I can't be arsed. And I remember looked at them then and was like, ah, shit, they're getting on there. And then now my dad's like 70 next year. And then all of a sudden, those people who were just like unbreakable to you are now 70-year-old. And my dad, who never was ever ill during his entire life, when he lost his business and he put his shoulder out and he couldn't carry on with his business and stuff. And then some bad shit happened, which I'm sure we can talk about another day. And then he's just not the same person. Like, his hearing's gone, his fucking teeth are falling out. He's just old.
Yeah.
And then everything's breaking every couple of weeks. It's always something wrong with him. So it's not as much me getting old, but it's the people that I love in my life getting old. That pains me more.
Yeah, it's the shift. It's the fact that everything moves along. Everything slides up towards death. It's having kids. It's because kids grow up like that. Now, when you're a kid, and there's a reason for this, is because of how much life you have. The more life you have, the more you have it to the time of life to compare against. So when you're 5, a year is a fifth of your entire life. Whereas seems when like you're 30, it's a 30th. You know what I mean? So a year flies by because it's a much shorter life comparative to what you've lived so far. The thing I find most difficult about all of this, it's not that I'm not 18 anymore. It's that I think I am 18 in my head. And I am very much not. And it's the and I've realised that, like, the people I will have judged at 18 are now people who are now in my age. You know what I mean? I need to look and go, God, he's so old. And when I watch football and I think about, like, James Milner being old,
James Milner's being old.
He's like 4 years younger than me. It's very, very upsetting. That's the thing, is that as a man, you never actually age mentally. You can become more experienced and more seasoned, and you can get a greater grasp on certain situations, and, you know, to avoid certain pitfalls. But ultimately, like, to think that the stuff we just talked about, like 2005 to me, I was an adult. You know, I was 23 years old or whatever at the time. 22,
were you acting like
22.
An adult?
You know, at the time, probably felt I was. But the point is, once you turn 19, 20, 21, you're effectively a grown. You are more or less the person that you are. You become a variant on that person as you get older. You don't fundamentally change anymore, so you don't, and you have all those memories, so you don't feel any particular difference. It's just when you look in the mirror and you start to see grey hairs, and it's like, oh, hello, where did you come from?
It's also like having to fucking watch what you eat. Like, that's shit, isn't it? You know what I mean? Now, it happened pretty early for me, and I didn't, and this is the problem that I'm still in right now, but like, I think you can pretty much, you don't get a hangover, I think, until you're 22 years old.
Not
a proper fucking hangover.
Oh, yeah, you think you get them.
But you don't know. Like, a two-day fucking can't function is a hangover, which I think you start getting when you're about 22, something like that. But then you just start putting on weight because you eat shit. And then now all of a sudden you're mid-30s, you don't have time. A lot of people don't have time to exercise. So you've got to watch what you're eating, which is fucking shit. And we've just come off the back of Easter, and you can't just eat Easter eggs all day. I mean, that's what adulting is, Paul. It's shite.
Yeah, no, it is. It's that you can now afford. You get to do the shopping, and you can buy whatever you want. So you can go and buy a whole packet of Jammy Dodgers if you want, and you can eat them all because no one's going to tell you not to eat them. And that's what real life is: the realization that there's no rules. There aren't any rules. You can do whatever the fuck you want at all times. But there are consequences to those actions, and it happens, like, it's like when you first get your you first have to pay your council tax, and you get your first reminder letter, or rather you get your second reminder letter, and you realise that you don't get any more reminder letters after that. And if you don't do it, you get a summons, and you get all this, and then all of a sudden you're in massive trouble, and no one comes across and goes, mate, that needs to get sorted, otherwise you're going to be in big shit. Well, they do, because it's a fucking letter and it's printed.
But that ranks below email.
Absolutely. So yeah, I can reply to it at my leisure. Absolutely, yeah. But it's more officious. That's the thing.
Right, James Button, can you speak about general funny stories and life lessons from back in your teens and 20s?
Yeah, well, defo. 100%, if you're here for that.
Yeah. I was stabbed once.
With a compass?
No, with a knife.
With a knife?
You know this story.
Was it by a chef?
It was by a chef.
Were you a KP?
I was a KP.
At the time?
So what happened was, I was working in a kitchen. And I used to have loads of injuries in kitchen because I'm quite a clumsy person. I say quite, I mean very. And basically what I was doing was completely just working in my own little section, doing the dishes, probably 15, 16 years old, something like that, tying my shoelace on the top of the sink because I'm a maverick and I didn't want to lean down to do it. So I put my foot up on the sink and tied my shoelace. And my head chef come in and basically stabbed me in the foot. Right. Which took me a little bit by surprise, to say the very least. It turns out that he was trying to cut my shoelaces, but what he did use was a 30-centimetre kitchen knife. And he went like that. And it went through my trainer, into my foot, at the top there. Anyway, needless to say, an ambulance was called. And I get into this fucking ambulance, and I'm having to protect my head chef at this point, who, by the way, is one of my best mates.
This is Carl.
It's Carl, yeah. And I'm trying to protect him, so I turn to the boss, and he's like, "What happened?" And he's like, he's on the bounce, like, and he was an angry little fuckwit with Steve. And he bounces, "What happened?" And I'm like, "I dropped a knife on my foot." And he's like, "You're a fucking dickhead." And they basically called me Blade Runner for the next 2 years while he was there. Anyway, I'm in the fucking ambulance, and my mum gets called, and she's in a right tiz. Like, she's a fucking...
Of course she is.
She's... I love her to bits.
Brenda loves a panic.
Fuck me, she loves a panic. Like, and we're in there, and the nurse, he asked me to take my sock off, and I'd not cut my nails for, let's just say, a little while. And my mum fucking bollocked me. Bollocked me. Not about the knife, about my toenails being too fucking long. Like, you know what I mean? It's like, fuck off, mum. And I'm like, getting so embarrassed. Because there's two nurses there, and she's bollocking me about my fucking toenails.
This is the same attitude, though. And my mum had this, and now my wife's got this, of like, when a person that you've never met before in your entire life and you will never meet again after this fact comes into contact with you, it's like you have to make sure that everything is in its perfect state. Like, we had someone come down to fix the washing machine, and the house had to be cleaned within an inch of its life. I was like, the washing machine repairman, honestly, does not give
he's
a
not
fuck.
He's not blacklisting yet.
He doesn't give a fuck. I mean, as long
not
as...
Going not going that again.
I know, as long as he's not crawling through, wading through knee-high filth to get to it, then you'd be absolutely fine.
One other one that I don't think I've ever told you about, because I only remembered this one the other week. We went out for a bite to eat. We went back to the Britannia, where I used to work. The pub on Riverside Drive, or you might call it the Dock Road, whatever, you'd be wrong. I lived above there, and I don't know if I've ever told you this one. They used to have this massive, like, chandelier coming down in the centre of the room. You worked there as well.
I worked there for a bit, yeah.
Like, do you remember it right in the middle of the restaurant, this huge sort of chandelier?
That was one of my summer of 2005 jobs, if you don't look back there.
Right. Alan, it was about 6:45, 6:30 in the morning, and I needed to change a light bulb. So I got up on the ladder, and I electrocuted myself changing the light bulb, and fell off it and knocked myself out. Right. And the cleaner thought I was dead when she came in. Like, I'm just on the floor, completely knocked out. There's a ladder there and, like, a fucking broken lamp or something.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, I'd fallen, like, fucking 7-8 feet off a fucking ladder. Off a fucking electrocution for a fucking light bulb.
I'm so sorry, that's not good. I was going to tell a story, actually, but now that you've reminded me about the Britannia, there's a great story from the Britannia, one of the few shared stories we have from that job. Was me, Chris, and a mutual friend of ours, Robin, had gone out for a night out the night before, and we got absolutely bladdered, and we ended up in, I want to say, it might have been Bato or something like that. It was one of those indie bars in town. And I had, again, this was during my I have no money, I'm largely unemployed phase of my life. So I needed both of the lads around me in order to, like, basically help me get home, to share the taxi, etc., etc. We lost you. And in order to find you, we did the old movie, let's split up because we can cover more ground. I never saw Robin again that night. I had no money to my name. I had to walk home from town, which is a good, like, 50-minute walk. So I walked home and stopped at his house on the way back just to see if he was there. He was all right. You were flying to Barcelona with your missus the next morning at, like, 6 o'clock in the morning or whatever. The next day, I woke up hungover to sin, and I turned up to work, and the pub had been broken into and robbed, and I turned up not knowing this, and there's police there, and I go, and bear in mind, all three of us work in this pub at the time, and you're the manager who's got access to the safe. I walk in and go, has anyone heard from Chris and Robin? Because we were out on the lash last night, and they both went missing, and I've not seen them. And you can see the police going,
takes notes down. So you of course got on a plane and flew to another country conspicuously at the same time that the pub that you were in charge of got robbed. So that was it. I got questioned
when I came back.
Fantastic. The only other one I briefly want to mention before we move on was I once told the lead singer from the Human League, it was Phil Oakey, I believe, that it wasn't important. I introduced myself because I was mates with their keyboardist at the time. I said it wasn't important that I remember his name, by the way. It was more important that he remembered my name because I was going places. I mean, I was wrong, but I also...
Dickhead.
Life did not take off from that point. Yeah, I'm a dickhead, and my life went very much through the fucking shitter, miles and miles, Andy Dufresne style, crawling through the length of 7 football fields worth of shit before I've emerged to be the man I am today. And Phil Oakey, again, from the Human League, who travels the world being a famous 80s pop singer, rightly probably thought that was a massive gobshite.
Right, two more questions. Bob. Talk about your blue coat days. I'm there in year 13 now. When did you meet there and what happened? Let's talk about one specific story. I think we mentioned it briefly on one of the Red Men shows this week.
Okay.
Let's talk about general studies.
Okay. So Chris and I went to the same school from age 11, but we never really crossed paths because it was a massive school.
Because you were in the rubbish classes.
We were in the intelligent ones.
Rubbish.
We were in the ones... So basically, forms are graded with school. We didn't know this at the time, but I know this now, are graded by intelligence.
No, not true at all.
It's 100% true.
It's not. Basically, anyone that was cool and was good at sports were in two sets, and the intelligent people were in the other two. It makes it sound like it was the unintelligent. You can be both. You just can't be good at sports and in one of your classes.
I was in the football team and in the intelligent classes.
You were a goalkeeper, Paul.
Still. Chris was neither.
B team for a bit.
B team
for a bit.
Yeah,
B team.
Yes, we didn't have class. We didn't have classes together until sixth form. I don't really think we ever had any classes together until general studies came up in A level. And can you remember what the name of this class was?
No,
it was like something like appreciating art or some shit like that. It was some bullshit excuse, and you had to pick a handful of them. And ultimately, general studies, you had to pick them to fit around the rest of your lessons. So I got into. We started this class, and we picked it. I think we picked it together, and we ended up sat together for
There's
the first
no way
time ever.
I would have picked that if you weren't in that class.
Yeah. So we picked it. And it is a wonderful insight into the mind of Chris Pajak, by the way. And following on from our conversations of last week, how Chris does things sometimes. They were taking the register, and obviously M becomes before P, Machin before Pajak. So when the name come round, Paul Machin, Chris puts his hand up and goes, here. So the teacher then automatically thinks, well, there you go, Paul Machin's here. So I'm left with Chris Pajak, here. Which was hilarious, absolutely hilarious. We got to pick an artist that first lesson who'd inspired us and do a talk on them. We picked Neil Buchanan from Art Attack. We've always been a great team.
Needless to say, this went on for 3 or 4 weeks?
A few weeks until I was forced to change one of my lessons around because I think I changed sets, I think, in French. So I did French at level. Jean-Paul Sartre in French. So I couldn't go to that class anymore, and you could.
Yeah.
So we were left with a situation where
I basically had to admit what had happened.
Well, basically, before that, Chris Pajak got in big trouble for not turning up to his general studies lessons, and at which point Chris had to fess up and say, I've been here all along. It was a humorous jape for me to pretend to be another student. It's backfired massively because now I've got a note against me on my permanent record for not turning up to lessons. Can you please? I'm here.
I don't remember what happened with that class. I don't remember if I ever finished it or what. Like, I can't even really remember anything past those first few weeks.
To be fair, this was also around the time where you decided to take a week off school to play Champ Manager.
It was a good decision.
It was a solid decision. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Listen to some good albums then.
There's plenty of Blue Coat Days. I feel sorry for anyone who goes to that school because it's fucking shit. It's like Hogwarts without the magic.
It's totally true. Yeah. Last question, man like Rudolph, a GCSE is worth the stress and probably going to fail, so does it matter?
Yeah, quick answer, yeah.
Longer answer, not really.
Yeah.
Here's the thing, right? I heard this week or last week, something like that, where basically someone that I'd spoken to had said they just blag the GCSE results on CVs and their A-levels because no manager ever checks. They don't ask for the certificates of your GCSE results. So it technically doesn't fucking matter.
Can I ask you? Did you ever they gave you that record of achievement folder thing?
Yeah.
Did you ever put your stuff in it?
No.
No. My wife's is absolutely glorious.
Has she ever been asked to get it out?
I think in the early days of teaching, yes. But like now, but I looked at it. Mine's probably got like me
5 meters first swimming
certificate in it or something like that. My Coca-Cola soccer schools past certificates from when I was on
Ian Rush fucking soccer schools.
It's got absolutely not on in it.
I think you can pretty much just blag results because nobody, I worked as a manager for, let's say, 10 years probably, give or take. Never asked for GCSE results certificates or A-level results certificates, or in fact, proof that you did pass university with the grades that you said you did. But what I will say is, and we've talked about some of Paul's shit jobs already today, having worked a lot of shit jobs, you really do need to get them at the same time because what happens is you get shit GCSE results, you get shit A-levels, you settle to go to a shit course in university, you either pass that or you fail that, you come out, you're miles behind where people are who have actually done work in all of this, and you end up in a job that you don't really like. And one of the things that you have when you're growing up is, you mentioned it again before, this fear of missing out. And this fear of missing out is like a night out with your mates or something like that, right? Imagine that you're missing that Friday night out because you might be revising, spread over 15 years because you're working in catering.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, there's a fear of missing out on one good night out.
Yeah.
I missed birthdays, fucking footy matches, all kinds, everything, yeah. Because I was working in catering.
I think of it like, you do, GCSEs are important. Like, the exams themselves, ultimately your results, because you're right, you can blag your results. It's what you learn in GCSEs. If you want to go to higher education, having good, I was limited because I couldn't be asked to change where I went to sixth form, so I stayed in Blue because it was easier. It was like a default. I just basically turned up on the first day and I was still enrolled, rather than doing anything else. But I could. You had in that school, you had to have, I think, a B grade or above to be able to study that subject. So that limited what I was able to study at A level, and I hated my A levels as a result. I didn't have many options I could go. I hated French at A level, and the only thing I could change it to was Spanish. And it's like, great, I'm better at French than Spanish. So, you know what I mean? What's the fucking point? So in that regard, you open more doors to yourself at that stage. I don't think you necessarily need A levels. I think you can go and do whatever. And the world's changed that you can kind of be. There's more avenues to be different things. But if you want to go down the traditional get a job route, knowing stuff helps. Having bits of paper and stuff to back it up is dead right. Because look, there's just a ton of jobs that you can walk into with a bit of nous, common sense, and the gift of the gab. The people who go on and earn mega money and do the big stuff, the really important stuff or whatever, they tend to be on a pathway to it. I say keep your options open, and exams ultimately are just a method by which people who don't really want to know you get an understanding of you, which isn't fair, but it is. It's like how you drive on your driving test. It doesn't really define you as a driver. It's not going to change how you drive for the rest of your life, but you need to do mirror signal maneuver. You need to move your head. You need to show them that
you can, essentially. Exactly. That's all you do with a driving test, isn't it?
So, yeah, definitely.
So there you go. That's been the second MXP podcast. Paul, thank you very much for joining me. Si, thank you very much for cutting it all together. And we'll see you next time. Leave us your thoughts, of course, in the comment section. Leave us some questions for next week to answer at the end.
5-star reviews, because this should be available on audio platforms.
Yeah, we're going to have a chat about that straight after this.
Eventually it will be. Yeah. 5-star reviews.
Now, yeah, seriously, thanks very much for your comments. Leave us your thoughts in the comment section below. Like the video, subscribe to MXP if you haven't already. I so nearly said the Redmen TV then.
Years and years of practice. Did you ever see the first ever, that Soccer USA show that Tim Lovejoy did? He left Soccer AM and he did this in the first episode. He basically tried to do the writing email address and basically said Soccer AM and then went, there you go, I've been doing that for 15 years and that's the problem. So yeah, it's a pass. I mean, no one had noticed if you hadn't said it. And then I'd drawn further attention to it.
It is true. No better way to end than that, really.
Share the podcast if you enjoyed it. That's the most important thing to do, guys.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.